make sure that people have access to fair housing. And we have to do things that are affirmative. The situation we're in was put in affirmatively, right? And so we have to have affirmative plans to reverse it or to correct many things that we believe are wrong. And Dr. Ben Carson, one, doesn't believe that, unfortunately, which is something that is a policy decision. But on top of that, just has absolutely no experience at all when it comes to anything related to anything that HUD does. And one has to try to figure out why these are the appointments that are being made.
I want to turn to Ben Carson speaking in 2013 about the challenges of his childhood with a local radio station in Baltimore.
Having grown up in dire poverty, the thing that I hated the most in life was poverty. I just hated poverty. But as I began to read those books, particularly about people of accomplishment, I began to realize that poverty was really more of a choice than anything else, and that I could change that. And it just really depended on how hard I wanted to work.
That was Dr. Ben Carson talking about poverty as a choice.
He said poverty is a choice more than anything else. I'm just astonished by that comment. And I have a feeling that both he and the president-elect believe that. That's what's particularly scary. That's why we believe the billions of dollars that the state receives is in jeopardy now, which is only going to exacerbate a problem that already is huge.
Before we wrap up, you refused to stand for the Pledge of Allegiance at a City Hall meeting in September. What were you protesting?
I have personally not said it in a very long time. I always stand out of respect. I decided to stay seated and kind of do what Kaepernick was doing and people we're doing across the country, really to say that there is a problem here when it comes to police violence and gun violence that I believe is being ignored by not giving the proper resources to communities. And I defy anyone now to tell me about patriotism and what America stands for while we've elected a man who ran on everything that's anathema to what people say that the America stands for.
Well, Jumaane Williams, New York City Council member, chair of the New York City Housing and Buildings Committee, thanks so much for joining us for this hour. This is Democracy Now! That does it for the show. Special thanks to the staff and crew at Riverside Church who helped with our 20th anniversary celebration, Darwin Darling, Michael Arias, Tamisha Johnson, Nancy Valadares, Richard Glassy, Tanya Dunlop, and a special thanks to Democracy Now! Staff who helped with the event, Aaron Dooley and Jemiah Lewis, Karen Ranucci, David Prude, Paul Huckabee, Sam Alkoff, Trina Ndura. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio is currently hiring for the following three positions: station manager, evening news and public affairs director, and director of underwriting. To apply to one of these positions, send a cover letter and resume to hiring@kboo.org, or bring or mail your resume with cover letter to 20 Southeast 8th, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Please answer the following question: why is KBOO important? Open until filled. Interviews will begin around December 9th. No phone calls, please. KBOO Community Radio is an equal opportunity and affirmative action employer. Women and people of color are encouraged to apply. For more information, go to kboo.org.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to sponsor the Elysian Brewing Breakbeat IPA KBOO Benefit on December 8th at the Liquor Store Bar and Venue in Portland. KBOO and Elysian Brewing will celebrate the release of the Manic IPA series with hip-hop, funk, and electronica spun by The Pariahs, DJ Dakimba, and Vinology. Again, that's Elysian Brewing Breakbeat IPA KBOO Benefit on December 8th at the Liquor Store Bar and Venue, 3341 Southeast Belmont Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Oh, And good morning. This is Paul Rowland, unexpectedly hosting my show here live from Standing Rock, the Oshete Sakuin camp. I don't really want to steal the thunder from Jacqueline Keeler's first solo hosting slot, but I was just calling in to listen in, and it turns out that she's late, so here I am. And it turns out that I have some news. I just was on the phone with Chairman Dave Archambault of the Standing Rock Tribe just a couple minutes ago, and so I have that to report. And as soon as Jacqueline gets in, she'll be on, and I'll let her take it from there. So as people might know, that there's an announcement by the Army Corps of Engineers just a couple days ago that they denied the easement, they denied the permit for drilling underneath Lake Oahe, the Missouri River, the dammed Missouri River, which has been the request from the tribe and many people for many months now. And so there's a lot of jubilation in the camp when that was announced by Chairman Archambault on Monday. There's a lot of different voices going around about, well, what's actually going on. The chairman said that there is no drilling going on at the drill pad site to go under the river. There never has been any drilling, is his words. He says that there's the idea, people have been saying that there's going to be a potentially, I don't know how many, $50,000 or something a day fine if they do drill, that the company was just going to go ahead and drill anyway. Again, according to the chairman, that's not true, that actually the Energy Transfer Partners, Dakota Access Pipeline company, is risks a complete shutdown of the project if they do start drilling. Again, these are Chairman Dave Archambault's own words. And he feels like they basically achieved everything that they've been asking for. And now with these Arctic conditions here, it's incredibly bitter cold with a bitter wind. There was a blizzard a couple days ago, made things very difficult here at camp. Shut down a lot of the roads around the area. People have been leaving the camp nevertheless. Still a lot of people. A lot of people were at the casino, the tribe's casino, about 7 miles away from the camp here. There was a powwow, very powerful powwow with many of the veterans. As people know, there was a call out by General Wesley Clark's son, Wes Clark Jr., and the ex-Baltimore policeman and military veteran, whose name I can't remember, to for veterans to converge. And estimates range from 2,000 to 3,000 veterans were here. And most people think that that's what kind of finally forced the hand of the Army Corps of Engineers to actually make that historic, fairly unprecedented announcement that the easement would be denied, which definitely creates major complications. Of course, what's going to come about eventually, no one knows, with the new Trump administration, et cetera. The chairman also said that you know, their request is fundamentally to get the pipeline off of tribal land, stop, having fossil fuel infrastructure and environmental devastation on the backs of native peoples. The basic bottom line was to move the pipeline, get it off of tribal lands. Of course, if and when that happens, it will create even further complications for the company. They may, you know, miss their deadline, their January deadline, to finish the project. So just lots going on. So basically his stance is that, you know, it's upon us, you know, non-Native Americans to basically change our entire way of life, reduce our consumption of fossil fuel, and make such pipelines unnecessary, and stop, you know, basically the whole colonization process of Native peoples, which has led to such terrible devastation over the centuries. So I don't know if Jacqueline has come in yet. Apparently not. But I guess I'll just continue hosting my own show, which, as I said, I wasn't prepared to do. But as people know, the number to call in on is 503 231-8187. I've been here since Friday night, so I've had a taste of the camp here and camp life. It's a very intense community experience. Everybody's pulling together. I was shoveling a lot of snow on a hill where cars had to get out of one of the sections of the camp yesterday, and everybody's scrambling to get firewood, so we're hauling firewood. Everybody's trying to get propane heaters to stay warm. There's just incredible outpouring of support from all across the country and all around the world. There's just the donations just keep piling on. So if you want to send clothing, please don't send any more clothing. We've got way more than we can use. No more need for blankets, sleeping bags. I believe all that is pretty well taken care of. I'm sure cash donations are still definitely desired, because it takes a lot of money to maintain these battles. There's going to be looks like a reduced camp presence, which is probably good for the health and well-being of everybody. There's been a number of small injuries from people slipping on the ice. It's, you know, was falling the first full day I was here. There was falling because the sun came out, and was created very icy conditions. It's just an incredible sprawling camp. It's just mind-boggling. You just wouldn't believe it. There's just teepees and army tents and yurts and smaller tents and bigger structures. There's, I don't know, probably 10 to 20 framed structures at this point. Between they're building a tool lending shed. There's a veterans building. There's a supply buildings. It's just the amount of work and love and good energy going in here is truly remarkable. Everybody's just really supportive of each other, and I could just go on and on about that. But again, if anyone wants to call in, 503-231-8187 is the number to call in, and I'll tell you what I know. There's some other people in the building here who might want to share their thoughts. So Paul Roland calling here from Oshete Sakun Camp in just outside of Cannonball, North Dakota, on Army Corps land right along the Cannonball River.
Hi, Paul. It's me, Jackie.
Oh, all right. You got it.
Yes.
So, as I said, I didn't mean to steal your thunder.
No, I'm so glad you called in. It's wonderful to hear that you're out there, and I'll be there tomorrow. So.
Oh, right on.
Or I'm flying out today. So, but I'm definitely gonna look at the present conditions with the cold weather and the spirit of the camp. I think the response to whether how seriously to take the Army Corps of Engineers announcement that they're going to not issue a easement under the under Lake Oahe, the Missouri River, for DAPL, for the Dakota Access Pipeline, and then you have a order and environmental impacts study to find other locations where they you have to find a different pathway for the pipeline.
Yeah, big news. I was here when Chairman Archambault made the announcement, obviously to the great jubilation of all the people around the fire, and then people, the traditional people came in with the Eagle Staff and danced around the sacred fire and sang, and it was an incredibly, incredibly moving experience. In fact, I'm getting moved right now talking about it. But I don't know if you heard, were on the radio hearing the show coming in, that I just got off the phone with Chairman Archambault just a couple minutes ago. I've been trying to talk to him for months now, and of course he's really busy, but he says that there's absolutely no drilling has started, and the word kind of around the camp was people were very suspicious. Obviously, as you all know, Native people have more than great reasons to be deeply suspicious of anything the government says.
Yes.
And sometimes that even carries over to elected tribal officials. So people were, you know, not sure what that all meant. And people thought that people were actually saying that the company had announced that they were going to go ahead and drill anyway and carry fines. But Chairman Archambault stressed that the reality is that if they actually do start drilling, they risk way more than just fines. They risk the shutdown of the complete project. Have you heard anything about that?
I saw that he mentioned that in the press release that the tribe put out yesterday. And I think that's the question: is what are they doing there? There is really, I know that the Army Corps, whether or not they have actual observers on site monitoring what they're doing at the drill site, that would be something that you would expect to have happening. But I don't know that it is. So I don't know.
And you would think that the provisions for the company to be required to report on a day-to-day basis on what their activities are.
Yeah, they definitely are very willful, and they are facing some pretty serious deadlines of their own. January 1st, all their contracts, the contracts for the delivery of the oil that they signed in 2014 will be up for renegotiation, at which point they will have to sell it for much less. I think in 2014 it was just below $100 a barrel. Now it's like about almost $50 a barrel, so they could lose a lot of money if they don't make this January 1st deadline. So mm-hmm. they are probably willing to risk all kinds of things. But I would definitely want to investigate more the claim that that they could actually risk the entire project by the drilling. I think the Energy Transfer Partners statement was definitely very defiant and did not take. Just seem to, to say they're going to go ahead with the project. And they actually have a motion, a hearing for a motion this Friday in federal court, U.S. District Federal Court, and with Judge Boasberg again. And they will, they're trying to say that that because the Army Corps of Engineers already approved all these permits, that the easement is just a formality. It's not something they really need. Yeah, that's coming up on Friday. So we're gonna have Angela Bibbins on here in about less than 3 minutes, and she is an attorney. Oh, she is on the phone. Okay, maybe we should.
I'll bow out and let you guys carry on. Thank you for doing the show, and I'm glad I was able to just get a little bit of new information in there. And
I'm so glad you're there, Paul, and I'm so glad you called in. Very grateful.
Okay.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye. So, yeah, we have, I guess we have on the line right now, Angela Bibbins. She is, did we just lose her? Oh, that was not Paul. We have Angela Bibbins. She is an attorney for the Water Protectives Legal Collective, which she's been on site for many months now at the Ocheti Shakowin camp, the main camp where all those thousands of Native people are gathered right now and their allies. And last count, I heard there were 10,000 people at the Ocheti Shakowin camp. And Ocheti Shakowin is our word, our Lakota word for the Great Sioux Nation. My name is Jacqueline Keeler. I am the guest host today. As you hear, Paul is in North Dakota. And I myself am Ihanktawan Dakota. And so, and I have a lot of family at the camp right now. And I will be going there. Actually, I'm leaving this evening. So, I think do we have Angela on the line? Okay, great. Angela?
Yes.
Hi. Would you like to introduce yourself some more and give about the work you do there at the camp?
Sure. My name is Angela Bibbins. I'm an attorney from Colorado. I'm also Santee Dakota by heritage. My dad was an enrolled member of the Santee Sioux Nation in Northeast Nebraska. I've been the ground coordinator for the Water Protector Legal Collective since late August. And this week, I am snowed out of camp when we had a criminal defense strategy meeting in downtown Bismarck. So I've been kind of hanging out in Bismarck, working on some of the criminal defense issues.
Great. And what was your response when you heard the news on Sunday?
When I heard the news on Sunday, I felt like it was a victory, but one that is perhaps temporary and fragile. So I understand why our water protectors have dug in spite of the blizzard, the second blizzard that we've experienced in 2 weeks, in order to, you know, keep an eye on what Dakota Access is doing at that drill pad.
And I understand that you guys have just launched also a class action suit because on behalf of the water protectors who were assaulted by the police.
Exactly. That was the Sunday evening, November 20th. I was in camp that evening and helped to coordinate the emergency relief response for the mass casualty incident that the Morton County Sheriff's Department perpetrated on over 300 water protectors. They unleashed water cannons in 22 degree temperatures, causing over 200 people to be wet and exposed in the elements, and many people were injured, some very seriously, by rubber bullets, beanbag bullets, what we are calling concussion grenades. They go by flashbangs and a couple of other nomikers. And we have been, you know, providing support for the water protectors around that particular incident, not only, you know, legal support, but helping to guide them for medical care and emotional support, and sometimes spiritual support, which is, you know, through prayer and ceremony at camp.
And you've been at the camp for a long time now. When did you first arrive at the camp?
August 22nd. And I actually came initially with my three-year-old son, because it's a family experience. It's, you know, cultural immersion experience. I was a lost bird. My dad and my mom separated when I was a baby, and I didn't really have the opportunity to be raised around my culture. And I, you know, have made a conscious effort to expose my children, and everything was working out pretty well in that regard until the day that Dakota Access unleashed their private security and dogs that feloniously attacked and assaulted my relatives and allies. And then it was clear that camp has, you know, has had an increasing element of danger for the water protectors, children, families, elders, anybody who has, you know, all the water protectors who have so much courage to keep going back to the front lines and take a beating from the police.
And yet the camp has continued to grow. I think it went from 2,000, it went up to 5,000 in September, then to 2,000 in October, and then this month it went up to what, nearly 10,000?
For sure. The influx of the veterans, what an amazing stand of solidarity that they have shown, Standing Rock Sioux Nation and all of the tribal nations that are gathered there. There was a reconciliation event that was held at the Prairie Nights Casino a couple nights ago, where the veterans in the casino pavilion asked for forgiveness from tribal elders from all around the country for the offenses that the military has perpetrated on Indian nations throughout history in this country.
Wow. That I saw the video of that. That was really moving and amazing. And I think that sort of illustrates what this whole experience has been like for not only for the Dakota people, but also for all of Indian country. It's this incredible moment where we get to stand up for our rights. We get to see who our allies are and who our enemies are. I mean, quite frankly, and really begin to consolidate who we are, our identity, and deal with the past, although it is incurring a lot of trauma today.
It's true. It's kind of, where people have come together at camp, there's been so much healing. And then the purpose of the camp to resist this pipeline has also brought more trauma into our communities.
Yeah. Yeah, that's something that, do you want to bring Nikki on to Yeah. Okay. So we also have on Nikki Parkhurst. Nikki Dasheni Parkhurst. Are you there, Nikki?
Yes. Hello. Hi, Jacqueline.
Yeah. And your family, your mother's family is from Cannonball, and you've been working with trying to organize the local community and deal with the trauma that Angela's pursuing the lawsuit about.
Yes. So I am Standing Rock Sioux and Navajo, and my mother, Greta Konica, she grew up in Cannonball. She lives there in the district as well as my brother and my other maternal family.
Mm-hmm. And how has that been, the trauma around this fight against the pipeline? How has that been for the local community?
So, you know, I can only speak about what I've observed and what I personally have heard as I'm in the Standing Rock Sioux community, whether it's attending tribal meetings or district meetings, but or even talking with my own personal family. I'm in the Oshete Shakun camp and all of the water protectors who are there and supporting and standing with them. But the response, the militarized police response, is one that I think is really affecting them. Obviously we know that the people who have been in those direct lines and those direct actions up against the police are probably going to be facing some type of trauma down the line if they're not already. But I also know that community members are still facing those types of same anxiety and stress related to what's happening. I know that my mother, when she works at the casino, at Prairie Nights Casino, and she would text me different kinds of things that she was hearing. I just heard that they shot somebody. This is before they knew that they were using rubber bullets. At one of the events, she said, "There's rumors that people were shot. People were shot. I don't know how they were shot. I don't know what's happening. Can you tell me more information?" And so I think if you're that close to some type of warlike situation, and you may not be directly involved in it, but to hear things and not know exactly what's going on, and to be fearful for other people's safety, it's impactful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Angela, how much, what kind of liability does the Morton County Sheriff's Department have in this? I mean, what are they facing with the lawsuit?
I think with the lawsuit, they are facing responsibility for people's costs related to their injuries. And that's not only physical injuries, but some of the emotional, the intentional emotional infliction of emotional distress that comes from this 1983 tort action. And so, you know, we are still doing the investigation to add plaintiffs to this case. We really encourage our relatives and allies, if they know somebody who was injured that night or any of the other preceding conflicts with the police, to please come and either call our legal support hotline or to get in touch with us at camp at the legal tent.
And I noticed that the Morton, I saw some notices on Facebook that the Morton County Sheriff's actually took down their Facebook page. Was that a liability issue because of some of the comments they had made?
You know, I can't really comment as to the prudence or lack of prudence in how Morton County Sheriff's Department has used their Facebook page. But certainly I have seen them post some pretty offensive and actually, you know, things that are contrary to a pending an investigation and in the way that they've been wording things about the water protectors.
Mm-hmm. And what is there a number value you can put to the case, the class action suit, where it stands now, or...
I can't actually at this point. We have much more evidence that we are still gathering, plaintiffs that have agreed to be added. And so it's just going to be an ongoing thing. We put them on note. We put Morton County Sheriff's Department on notice that we would be filing. And within a week, we wanted to get it filed. So that's why we took the action with the six initial plaintiffs that we did.
I see. And Nikki, How does it feel for the community of Cannonball to suddenly realize just to see the naked racism around them that they're going to have to live with, even for years to come, the realization of just the hatred that still is in the surrounding non-Native communities?
So I've been visiting my mom's community since I was a kid, and even into my adulthood. And I remember going to visits in Bismarck or Mandan and being treated differently. When you're very young, I don't think you recognize what that difference in treatment actually is. But as I become an adult and as I've brought my own children to visit with family there in Standing Rock, that it's been very recognizable that that difference in treatment is related to being Native and basically racism being perpetrated by residents there. I know that based off of conversations with my own family while I've been up there in Standing Rock since October, that there is much more overt actions of racism that the community is experiencing. I believe that they know that racism has always been there, but it's always just kind of been under their actions, or they happen to know it, that there's some type of differential treatment, but they're not entirely sure that's connected to racism. But definitely with the Water Protectors convening there and a very large influx of Native Americans, that there have been some negative tones as to how the neighboring communities are treating Standing Rock Sioux, even their children when they go to different kinds of like off-reservation sports games. That was something that was mentioned at a district meeting, that the Standing Rock Sioux children were being called names. They were being taunted by a non-Native, the guest, the host, who they were visiting. And I think part of that is just recognizing that type of way of thinking and thought has always been there, has always existed. It just happens to be now that for some reason the non-Native neighboring communities feel they can be much more overt in how they display it.
Yeah, I think I think, you know, when I was at the camp, I ended up at the Cheyenne River Sioux camp. They made me sit and drink coffee with them, the elders there, and eat stew. And one of the grandmothers there was telling me that her granddaughter has a blog. Her name is Lyric Ironwing. And a lot of the students from their reservation go to off-reservation schools to get a better education, where there are minorities in these mostly white schools, high schools. And she said that they were facing a lot of harassment, like if they wore, T-shirts, Stand with Standing Rock T-shirts, and that one boy, it was very traumatic. I mean, it's very hard for them. And one boy actually tried to commit suicide under the pressure of the overt hatred that he was experiencing at school from white students, and I think that's the idea that she would live in a place where you always knew that there was this divide, but now it's visible. And even with all these terrible things, the water cannons and the rubber bullets and the dog attacks, and the local community still has no sympathy for the Native community or the Native Standing Rock Sioux tribe stand to protect its culture and its people. Angela?
Yeah.
So do you have any with the whole I don't know if you're very with the whole process with I know that the Energy Transfer Partners has a motion hear their they had put a case in federal court to not have to waive the requirement for the easement.
Yeah, I'm aware of that motion, but since I there's sort of a hierarchy of lawyers involved with the pipeline, and the legal collective is, more on the ground for the legal support and services of the Water Protectors, while we have a lot of people within the collective who have some environmental law knowledge. I'm really just learning that
through this process. I know that they've applied for an appeal to be able to still drill. You know, they have all these investors that are facing some financial jeopardy if they are unable to meet their deadline by January 1st. And so, you know, for them, there's a lot of money on the line. And what I tell water protectors is that we're in a spiritual battle. We worship the earth, and Dakota Access Pipeline and their investors worship money, and they're going to do whatever they can to fulfill the requirements of their funders at all costs, and it has definitely seemed to be at all costs.
It definitely feels like they, you know, when you see, I had a friend of mine, she's Lakota from Pine Ridge, and she was saying that when she sees the sees our two cultures standing off, you know, against each other, and despite all the things that they've done to our people, to harm us, you know, boarding schools, to sort of mark us with trauma, yet we still, in this standoff, we're the peaceful ones. We're the ones who are there in prayer and ceremony, fighting for the things that really matter. And she was saying, I see our two cultures facing off, and like, you can clearly see which is the better one. And that makes her tremendously proud. And, you know, and I think that, I think a lot of, as traumatic as all the violence that the law enforcement has been dealing out, and the lack of sympathy from many North Dakotans, you know, it's still like this, and obviously we need to counseling and everything to work through the trauma for everyone in the communities and the individuals who have been subjected to it. But yeah, I think I see it as the reemergence of the Great Sioux Nation, of the Ocheti Shekowin. And what do you each think of that? Nikki, could you go first?
Yeah, so one of the things that I am doing, I was up in Standing Rock since the beginning of October, and coming back and forth to my home in Arizona. I'm currently in Arizona right now. One of the things I am trying to coordinate down here, as well as in other large Native American urban communities, is for some type of reflection and healing opportunities for water protectors who are returning to their home communities, especially where, you know, there may have been a large portion of water protectors from one specific area. So I know, for example, here from Arizona, especially in the Phoenix Valley, we have a good number of water protectors who have been living up there for months, for weeks, or who go back and forth for a weekend. And something that I am trying to get off the ground here is for some type of talking circle, so that way people can discuss their experience there and to really talk through any type of trauma that they may have experienced or any kind of violence that they've experienced. I think what we know about, you know, Native American, I mean, even not just Native Americans, but anybody who has experienced any type of traumatic experience, that if they hold it in and they don't discuss it, especially like our co-talkers who, you know, may not have been able to share their experience or even talk about what they experienced and observed, they were affected by it. And so that's something that we want to try to be able to prevent as our water protectors are coming home, so that way they can, you know, move forward in their communities, as well as being able to move forward in helping local causes as well.
And I should know that you are a graduate student at Arizona State University.
Yeah, so I'm currently a graduate student at ASU, Arizona State University. I am getting my second master's degree and that will be in public policy. I already have a master's degree in social work, and that I've received years ago. So one of the things related to addressing these types of traumatic experiences or traumatic events is making sure that when people come back that they're, you know, they're healing from it and they're being able to reflect on what they've experienced and talk about it.
And Angela, I know that there has been a lot of medics and therapists at the camp working with the with a lot of the folks who were assaulted.
Yes, and I just wanted to thank it's Nikki, right, for your work, because the law has its limitations. We
you know, we say that when we bring suit that we are attempting to make a victim or a plaintiff whole in the legal process. But I can certainly attest that what the law can do does not create the kind of wholeness that people deserve. Money doesn't create wholeness. There are so many other things in our culture that can help people to patch together the things that they have lost. And there have been many losses that I have bared witness to in this resistance effort.
Yeah, and of course, some of the folks injured at the November 20th assault include Susie. She's actually a Navajo woman who was up there fighting, and she has lost her eye. And she was shot point blank. Was it with pepper spray and also with a rubber bullet? And then also, and she received very poor care afterwards because, of course, they are blockading the road, which prevents emergency vehicles from reaching the camp and reaching even the reservation. And then, of course, the young woman, Sophia Wilansky from Brooklyn, New York, who I'm not sure, but I know that she was facing losing her arm because of being shot at point blank with one of those concussion grenades. And so I think, though, you know, it's this, yet it seems like the spirit at camp is hopeful. I think that people are, even though winter is coming, winter is here, and it's probably one of the worst winters they've seen in maybe, I've heard, over 10 years. And it's going into the single digits this week. And yet people are holding fast. People are, they seem to have their spirits seem strong. Nikki, would you like to speak to that?
Yeah, so I think the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers made a statement earlier this week about not approving at this time the final easement for the Energy Transfer Partners to place the Dakota Access Pipeline underneath Lake Oahe or the Missouri River. And I personally see that as a victory and a momentous decision or statement even about what that means for the Saniwak Sioux tribe and all tribes, all Native American tribes, and in terms of recognizing that tribal nations have an inherent right to say when things that are large infrastructure projects that are going to impact their people, their land, their resources, their spirituality and culture, that they have tribal nations have a right, an inherent right to speak up about those things and say no, or at least to have that decision considered, their mm-hmm. statement and their position on whether or not to have that go through their land to be considered. And I think that's a really great victory. I personally know and that there are my family members are pleased with that statement from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. And I think that everybody is hopeful that with the environmental impact statement, that it will be able to address some of the issues that the Saniwak Sioux tribe have had because they weren't meaningfully consulted on all of these different issues. Now, what does that mean in terms of an environmental impact assessment and exactly which part of the pipeline or to what extent will it cover is still up in the air. I don't know those details, but I think that people are hopeful that this is something that the tribal chairman, David Archibald II, was advocating from the very beginning, that the tribe be meaningfully consulted, that an environmental impact assessment happen, and then an environmental impact statement be released.
Yeah, I think sometimes I think there are actually sort of two different agendas. Like for the tribes, I think the agenda is meaningful consultation on projects that impact their lands and their people, and basically recognition of their sovereignty. You know, tribes are sovereign nations within the United States. Many Americans don't really understand this, and that. The treaties are treaties are only signed between two sovereign nations. They're not signed between the United States and random collections of U.S. citizens. And so by actually ratifying, you know, the Senate ratifying a treaty with the Great Sioux Nation, they recognized the sovereignty, you know, the pre-existing sovereignty of our nation. And so the treaty rights that encompass much of the land that where the DAPL pipeline corridor is, it is within the 1851 Fort Laramie Treaty that the Great Sioux Nation signed with the United States, and of which we still retain certain rights. This is unceded treaty land, and you know, I was speaking on Friday with Peter Capasala, who is a he used to be the attorney for the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. He lives here in Oregon, and he said that he wrote the book basically on the two treaties and the Missouri River, and he just came out last year. And he was saying that the treaty is still the tribe did allow utilities, lines, and railroad lines to go through that area, but they also had to have their consent. That the consent must be given, and consent is an even stronger level of tribal rights recognition, sovereign rights recognition, than consultation. You know, I think consent would then mean that if the tribe said no for any reason, then that would be it. And I know that the tribe released audio tape from September of 2014 where they clearly told Chairman Archambault and many of the council and tribal administrators told the DAPL representatives that they would not approve this crossing. And so under that reading of the treaty, then yeah, they would, that's totally within their rights to refuse, you know, and they don't really have to give a reason, I imagine. And Angela, are you still there?
Yep. Of course.
Yeah. And so do you feel like this is a chance to change the way other Americans view Native Americans? I mean, I think that there was this presumption 100 years ago that we would sort of fade away, that all the wrongs that were done, the breaking of treaties, breaking of international law by the United States, would just sort of fade into the past because there'd be no one around to hold the United States accountable.
Certainly, I feel very honored to be part of what is, you know, the hashtag on social media is Red Nations Rising. And I do look at this as an indigenous renaissance, that the assertion of our sovereignty, even the encampment at Otoji Shakowi, that many people there are, you know, even though there was an option to move the camp to Cannonball, many people have stayed because of the issue of unceded treaty territory that I have said from, you know, the first few weeks I was in camp that this is the most profound expression of sovereignty that the world has witnessed on Turtle Island. And I'm still really humbled to you know, play a small role in that and to support the water protectors in the assertion of those treaty rights. We are, as I said, we convened a criminal defense working group here through the National Lawyers Guild in Bismarck over the weekend, and we've had a couple of different meetings throughout the week. And one of the issues is asserting treaty unceded treaty as a jurisdictional defense for the arrests that have taken place in Morton County, because 90% of the arrests have occurred on unceded treaty territory. And you know, it's the position of the criminal defense team that Morton County doesn't have jurisdiction in that territory, and they had no real basis to make those arrests in the first place.
I think that's a really great step legally. I mean, there's this assumption that because they have violated, you know, international law for 150 years, that then it makes it that it's okay. And then of course a lot of the people of North Dakota have no knowledge of this legal basis that the tribes have, or even that tribes are sovereign nations. you know, many of them, I see them on Twitter and other places and Facebook, and there's this assumption that tribes are sort of this welfare state within the state of North Dakota without recognizing that the state of North Dakota is composed of a lot of land and extracts wealth from land that actually the tribe has a very strong legal claim to, probably stronger than the United States does, if the law was actually followed or acknowledged.
And I'm really, just to follow up, one of the attorneys on that working group who is the point person on the jurisdictional defense issue is Joe Heath, and he's the in-house counsel for the Onondaga Nation. And for those who may not know, the Onondagas are sort of the, like, old school, very traditional, like, they don't recognize the United States. They issue their own passports. They're not a gaming tribe. And he answers to the elders of his tribe when he is doing their representation. And, you know, they certainly have the model for how to do the jurisdictional defense.
That's great. Yeah, my husband is Six Nations, and of course, Onondaga is one of the Six Nations, the Haudenosaunee, the people of the Longhouse, and they were certainly the inspiration for, you know, the Constitution, the U.S. Constitution, and it had urged the colonies to join up together, which I probably regret now. But and my husband's grandfather was the he was the Bear Clan Mohawk chief, and he attended the first United Nations meeting after World War II in San Francisco with many other chiefs from Six Nations. And this is sort of ironic. The story is that they got to the Fairmont Hotel on Nob Hill there in San Francisco, and they had paid their own way to come from back east. And they got there, they got to the door, and they were asked who they were, and they said Iroquois. And the man, they were told that they weren't on the list. So they went back outside in front of the Fairmont and were like, what do we do? And they were like, well, let's try again. We came all this way. So they went back to the guy and they said that they were Iroquois. And this time he thought that they said they were Iraqi.
Oh.
And they got in as Iraqis to the meeting. And that just shows the diminishment. And certainly, you know, the Iroquois Nationals lacrosse team plays internationally and usually places third or something. And the whole team travels on passports that are from the Iroquois Confederacy and as a statement of their sovereignty. And certainly my husband and my children could get those passports as well. But it just shows, you know, this is a resurgence of sovereignty. This is a resurgence of reminding people who we are and asserting those rights. Nikki, are you still there?
Yes, I'm here.
Yeah. You know, you are also Navajo, and so am I. We're both enrolled members of the Navajo Nation. And you know, the Navajo Nation has 350,000 members. It's got a land base the size of Ireland, population the size of Iceland. It's larger than 22 member states of the UN. You know, it has the most people who still speak their language. I think it's in over 100,000 speak it fluently. You know, how do you see, I mean, now you see your father, your mother's people, you know, the Ocheti Shalcoan rising and really starting to assert themselves as a nation, all seven council fires, which go from Minnesota all the way to Montana. How does that feel?
You know, it's amazing. On my maternal side, my grandfather's land is land that was flooded by the Army Corps of Engineers when Lake Oahe was created. So our homelands are actually down near the confluence of the Cannonball River and the Missouri River, right where the pipeline will be going underneath. So we know that that land is important to us. And it was unrightfully taken away from us and away from our family. And I also know that, you know, there are many different issues across Indian country of governments stepping in, claiming eminent domain or taking or transferring land from that may be federal land that was originally Native homelands and transferring it to different kinds of private companies for development. You know, that's happening everywhere in the United States.
Yeah, I think here in Oregon, many of the tribes were terminated, and then their logging, their timber stands were then taken and sold.
Yeah, so you know what's happening, what has happened in Standing Rock, I believe is going to, I mean, we've seen it before happen throughout Indian country. For example, there were over 20 tribes here in Arizona that view the San Francisco Peaks as sacred. And there were fights to be able to keep fake snow or reclaimed water that was turned into snow off of the San Francisco Peaks.
Sewage water, right?
Treated sewage water off of the San Francisco Peaks. And there are still people who are fighting to protect that. Just now with what's happening on the Navajo Nation, we have fracking operations that are happening, and one in particular, they're in the very beginnings of their scoping meetings where they want to frack sacred land in Chaco Canyon.
Jeez. And there's very little water. There's very little water there. I mean, you know, fracking requires a lot of water.
So I think that and I'm very hopeful that what we will be seeing in Standing Rock is going to be replicated, and we're going to see this a lot more in independent news as well as, and hopefully, mainstream news about all of the different issues that Native people are fighting across this land.
It doesn't stop at Standing Rock. This is just a flashpoint of
Yeah,
and it's been amazing to see all those people coming together, seeing people from all different indigenous nations and all our allies coming together and being together in it. And the Camp Circle Society, you know, it's my great great aunt Ella Deloria. You know, she was an ethnologist, and you know, she wrote a whole bunch about it and interviewed a lot of elders starting in 1916. You know, she was raised there at Wakpala at Standing Rock, and and, you know, it just, you know, it just was such a, our culture, our social structure, how we live. I just remember my dad's family telling me that it was so painful to them when they had to leave the Camp Circle Society and live in houses separate from each other. And it was very hard on them emotionally and socially. And that to see the camp there alive together, standing together, and other people, other from other nations experiencing that with us is really gives me incredible hope. I mean, we've never camped through the winter for over 100 and some years. I mean, this is going to be a complete learning process. We will come through this as a new people, you know. Angela, would you like to add anything?
Sure. That totally resonates with me. Just on a personal note, I wasn't raised with my dad's family, and so I didn't have this cultural upbringing that I really felt was missing for a long time. And my process of going to law school, studying Indian law, was really the first time when all of these truths were revealed to me. And, you know, in particular, the history of breeding out the Indian through boarding schools and the adoption projects. And so I specialized in the Indian Child Welfare Act initially. And camp has really been the first time in my life that I've had this long of an experience of being immersed in my Dakota Lakota culture. And it's been healing for me personally, and knowing what it's like to live tribally, communally, and have the protection of relatives, the care and concern of, you know, your Chiwahe, your Chiospae, and your Oyate. It's just been profoundly meaningful to me, and I, you know, just have so much gratitude for that.
Well, I'd like to thank both of you for being on KBOO and sharing your stories, and we definitely will update more. And I'll be joining you there, Angela, on Thursday. I'll be there. And thank you so much for all your work there, Nikki, with your mom's people.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. And here's what we have coming up for you this morning on KBOO. It's 9 o'clock, so it's time for Political Perspectives. We'll look at the nationwide fight for 15 that workers are waging through protest and civil disobedience. At 10 o'clock, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia Headlines, Interviews, and Commentary. And then at 10:15, we got Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein, a victory at Standing Rock, an extended interview with Bill Means. At 11 o'clock on the Bike Show, we'll hear from Portland bicycle advocates about how pedal power is keeping the Standing Rock protest powered and connected to the media. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. A reminder that all new and increased gifts to KBOO are still matched one-to-one through the end of the year. Thanks to the Collins Foundation and SSI Shredding Systems. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate. We're going to listen to a couple of announcements, and then we'll get right to Political Perspectives, talking about the fight for 15. Thanks for tuning in.